from preaching, and so I am retired from Indiana Gas Company, where I worked 28 years, 20 of them in the general office, where I'm a supervisor of service. I was always free there to be my own man because I made way for it when I went there. When they called me into the general office to talk about my coming to be the first supervisor of service the company ever had, we met in the boardroom, and the president of the company told me what I was to bring to Indiana Gas Company. Then he said, well, maybe you have something to say. I said, yes, I do. I'm a Democrat. I'm a Quaker. I'm a member of the Civil Liberties Union, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and sometimes I am controversial. He said, that is your business. I said, I think so too, but I want you to hear it from me first. And so I was a free man. At the end of the day, when we sat down and over a cup of coffee, I would be asked, you see, gas utilities, all utilities, are sort of hotbeds of conservatism. But I was free to be a liberal man. When the day was over, we could sit down over a cup of coffee, and they'd ask me, well, what do Quakers think about this? What does the Civil Liberties Union have to say about this? And so I didn't have to be one man 5 days a week and another man the other two. And I liked that freedom. But the subject today is liberalism comes to Quakers. I've written a great deal through the years about my beliefs. And some of the things I can say to you in a quicker way, but just reading a little bit that I have written. A couple of years ago, the Earlham School of Religion, Earlham College, asked for an assessment how the Earlham School of Religion could serve the whole Society of Friends better. And I went to see the president of Earlham and talked to him a little while. He said, why don't you put that in writing? And so I did. I was one of 14 people in the United States that put their thoughts in a letter to the president and to Crane Associates, the people who were making the survey for Earlham. So a little bit of my own background in the Quaker faith is told best in this. Friends have been invited to participate in the National Consultation on Leadership in the Religious Society of Friends. Several friends have encouraged me to comment on the question asked of respondents. I welcome the opportunity to state my views on these issues. To help you weigh the value of my response, I should tell you a few things about myself and report my own odyssey among friends. I am not a theologian or a seminary graduate. Most of a formal education, much of it attained while in military service, has been of a technical nature. I am retired from the general office of gas utility. I'm an 82-year-old convinced friend coming to the society about 1953 after 6 years of Air Force service, which spanned World War II. During my upbringing, my family was under the sway of a fundamentalist religious faith. Being of an inquisitive nature and a voracious reader, I found that I could not accept this interpretation of Christian faith for myself. I came home from military service, shaken by service in India and Germany, having seen the destructiveness and human toll of war, blessed by Christians, I resolved that I would not become involved in organized religion. But I had reckoned without friends who were Quakers. This is still an emotional subject for me at times. I had reckoned without friends who were Quakers, friends who thought I should be a part of the church. These mentors changed the direction of my life's course. When I voiced my intellectual doubts about some events recorded in the Bible, I learned that many modern men and women had traveled this road ahead of me and had arrived at a faith which did not include an idolatrous attachment to a book which recorded mankind's checkered response to God. I learned that one need not take leave of one's critical faculties to be a Christian. My mentor friends convinced me the Quaker faith had everything to do with fashioning one's life according to the precepts of Jesus, not in believing impossible things about his birth, death, and resurrection. My first organized association with friends was with those who wanted to be regarded as evangelicals. During the next several years that I tried to find my place among friends, I was to learn the differences, anomalies, and contradictions in the society. In spite of the fact that there was much diversity in the yearly meeting, the official line was always a fundamentalist one. When I raised objections to this practice, I was told that I was in rebellion against the faith of my youth and callously invited to come home. I was greatly disappointed when I found that intellectual innocence is a virtue among some friends. In spite of the fact that the intellectual search is not encouraged among evangelical friends, I continued my search. For more than 50 years, I have collected and read books on theology and Christian religious thought, especially about the results of the nearly 200 years of historical critical study of the Bible. As I've tried to keep abreast of the knowledge available to us, I have come to the conclusion that the constantly refurbished fundamentalism, assiduously promoted in the Society of Friends, is not the way to a viable future for friends in a world growing more knowledgeable and more pluralistic by the day. I am now a member of a Quaker body which asks no one to assent to a creed. So I'm a member of Friends General Conference. Well, how about a yearly meeting of Friends General Conference, having left our meeting, having left association with Indiana Youth Meeting? I said that for some time after the war, I decided I wasn't going to have anything to do with organized religion. But it was the Quakers that drew me to it. I had known about Quakers for a time earlier than this episode. I was raised in a community that had a Quaker meeting. I did not attend a Quaker meeting, but I went to school, went to high school with a boy who was Quaker. Went to meeting a little bit with him when I was in high school. Had long discussions with him when I was in the military. But having been in India, where I saw just millions that had nothing, when I first went there, I couldn't eat because the kids would get up to our dining hall and press their faces against the window and wait for us to bring our trash out, our food that we didn't eat, and dump it in a trash can, and they would take clothing off their body and put it down on the ground and dump our garbage in the cloth and run away with the coffee being strained through the cloth. And I decided that the world wasn't organized in a way that I thought it ought to be, the moral way to organize the world. And I came home from India and I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I went to Germany, in the Army of Occupation in Germany. So I walked the streets of Nuremberg and Munich when they were still in rubble, and the smell, the stench of rotting bodies still coming from under the rubble. And so I was affected by the war in a way that I hadn't thought it would be. And since Christian faith largely had said nothing about it, I didn't want anything to do with it. But then, as I said, I joined a Quaker meeting that was a fundamentalist one. But I had not known what would be entailed in that either. You're not free to state your case, state the things that you do not believe, and keep in the good graces of people who believe otherwise. And so finally I went to an organization that didn't place much credence in what you believe. I ought to give you a little bit of the history of Friends. Friends started in England in the 17th century. George Fox is generally credited with being the founder of Quaker faith. He was born in 1624 and died in 1691. It was a Quakerism is often called the left wing of the Reformation. They were much like the Anabaptists on the continent. They did not make the Bible the primary authority in their faith. They were often called a third way. Catholics place the emphasis on tradition, on the authority of popes and people in authority. And the authority for Protestants was the Bible. Quakers originally did not place the emphasis there. Quakers said the authority is the light within, that God gives to everybody a light to guide him if he will follow that. And that appealed to me. I thought that that ought to be our guide, and we shouldn't depend on something as, and Barclay said it later in the apology, we shouldn't depend on anything so fragile as paper. But there is authority of the soul itself. Toward the end of Fox's life, he spent a great deal of his time and his efforts organizing Society of Friends in a way that it found that it had to be organized if it was going to last. There was a great deal of libertarian spirit among early friends. Everyone was his own leader. Everyone had his own guide. It very often led to different conclusions about what faith entailed. In fact, the libertarian spirit even carried it so far early on that they wouldn't even set a time of meeting. Everybody's supposed to know when he's going to meeting. It was a pretty libertarian or libertinism. They did not have the excesses that some of the other, the levelers and other dissident groups in England had. You can't understand early Quakerism without understanding the milieu in which it came. The English political revolution came about the same time. That century was in upheaval for a long period by the English Revolution. You know, they beheaded Charles I, and for a long time the interregnum of Cromwell in power. And so it was the Quakers being people that wouldn't pay the tithe and wouldn't swear, even on a Bible. A lot of them were in jail a lot of the time. And so they had to have organization. In fact, that's even where birthright membership came to Friends, because there was much suffering and children were left, parents would be in jail. The Quakers kept a list of children that had to be assisted by other friends because parents were in jail. That's where birthright membership comes from. We still carry it on, but it doesn't mean very much. People carry birthright membership all through their life. Nobody knew they were a Quaker until they died, and then they say they were a member of a certain Quaker meeting. That's the origin of birthright membership. At Fox's death in 1691, his death didn't make much of a ripple among friends because there was organization and people carried on. And Fox had been ill for a long time, and so his death caused very little ripple in the society. But another thing was happening about that time, the Enlightenment. Ordinarily, they say the Enlightenment, some people give a definite date, 1690. Some people say it began with the beginning of the 18th century. And anyway, the Enlightenment happened. There was a lot going on at the same time. Friends moved into the 18th century as a peculiar people. They wore special dress. They had what they called the hedge, to guard them from pollution by the world. They wore a different garb. They said thee and thou. They didn't even use the pagan names for days and months. They didn't say this is Sunday, February the 11th. They'd say this is second month, 11th. You see, Old Quaker Graveyard, you can always tell when you go into an Old Quaker Graveyard, he died in March 1890. He died third month 1890. And so we had our peculiarities, and those were supposed to guard us against the inroads of the world in our life. But that didn't happen either. With the Enlightenment, we had books, especially in England, there were a lot of books written by deists and other people that called in question some of the very foundations of Christian faith. Another event of that century was the rise of Wesleyanism. John Wesley, born 1703, died 1790. The Wesleyan revival had a great effect not only on France but on the Church of England. It had an effect ever since on Society of Friends, on a number of churches. Not only were Quakers affected by the Wesleyan brand of perfectionism, but the churches, the Mennonite Church and Presbyterians, or the idea of perfection, took hold on a lot of people, and it took hold of Quakers. Now there's not so much emphasis on second grace holiness as sanctification, a special work of grace that makes us perfect and sinless, but it had, now the people who follow the Wesleyan emphasis, we're more like dry clean Nazarenes. We don't baptize. That's one thing that we've kept in the Quaker practice. We don't baptize. Quakers had no ordinances. They didn't ordain preachers. They didn't have foot washing or communion. It was all internal. Everything was spiritualized. They even talked about Christ. They used Orthodox language, but they applied it in a different way. It was a Christ within. Still a common phrase among Quakers, Christ within. I had wished for a long time that we'd just say spirit. But that was a term that Jesus used when he's talking to the woman, and he said, the God is a spirit. And that's a very satisfactory concept of God to me. Even it helps us get through this fact that a theistic God, a God out there, a God unseen on a cloud somewhere with a rule book and a scorecard. We were all reared, or a lot of us was reared, this kind of a God. He was watching us, and he saw everything, and he recorded it. And someday, on the day of judgment, you're going to have to face that record. But if we can stick with the concept that God is spirit, it'll get us through a great deal of difficulties. I said that the concurrent with the revival spirit was the Enlightenment and the people that wrote about it that undermined the very foundations of fundamentalist faith. And that was a period too when American Quakerism grew very fast, and American Quakers were greatly affected by the American Revolution. Society of Friends, some of them were taken off for prison, and some, the Christian Quakers, the Free Quakers, established a meeting that lasted about 10 years of people that did support the American Revolution, but large Quakers suffered for their peace stand. In 1661, Quakers made a statement about peace, when they said that the Spirit of Christ by which we're led will never take us into war for the kingdom of Christ or for the kingdoms of this world. They wouldn't fight. So there were always suspect. There were people that you couldn't trust because you couldn't get them to fight for you. And that's one of the things I find attractive about Quakers. About the beginning of the 19th century, Irish friends had a little insurrection against the orthodoxy of the time. A woman Quaker preacher, Quakers had women preachers, and they went everywhere. We didn't make these distinctions between men and women in the ministry as people, other people did in that time. So there were women preachers. A woman named Hannah Bernard was a New York Quaker. She went to Ireland with a friend to preach, and she raised some questions about whether she believed these Old Testament stories about God killing, God commanding to kill all these people. And so she publicly stated that. Well, that got her in trouble with the elders. About the same time, an Irish friend, a respected Irish friend, a schoolmaster, Abraham Shackleton, raised the same kind of questions about the Old Testament and the stories they had about all these people that got killed at God's command. And both of them were censured by the Society of Friends. Hannah Bernard came home. She was censured by her own meeting. She turned to Unitarian. And Abraham Shackleton, I don't know what his religious future was, but he also was, I suppose we'd call it excommunicated. Quakers called it disownment. So there are a lot of people that in America that come from disowned Quaker stock. At one time they thought in the American continent everybody's going to be a Quaker. It didn't happen because they wouldn't fight. And you were disowned if you married out of meeting and didn't repent and properly say so. And so they were such a peculiar people that they didn't succeed in the world. But Orthodoxy was riding high at the beginning as we entered the 19th century. The Western Revival kept having a greater and greater effect on friends. And English preachers started coming to America. See, Quakers did not have the meeting for worship was silent unless someone was inspired to speak. And so very often the meeting sat in silence. And we had a group of people that more and more were the speaking was done by fewer and fewer people. When we became a pastoral, had a pastoral system, someone said, if God spoke in some Quaker meetings, he'd have to interrupt somebody. And that's just about the way modern Quakerism in among pastoral friends. If God spoke, he'd have to interrupt somebody because somebody else speaking, they very often say they're speaking for God too. But we had a preachers who came from England, and they were evangelical friends. They were people affected by the revival. And one of they had to come over here and preach to these benighted people that lived in the colonies, and but they very often stayed among city friends. This was a great part of the cause of the split in 1827 and 1828 among friends, when we got Hicksite friends and Orthodox friends. But they mostly wanted to stay in cities like Philadelphia, where the homes were better and the friends were richer. They had better accommodations. And so most of them were called to work around Philadelphia or other cities surrounding Philadelphia. They very seldom visited rural friends, where roads were bad. So the city friends became more Orthodox, thinking that creeds were more important. A little while before the 1827 split, Philadelphia Yearly Meeting even wrote a creedal statement about things that it was necessary to believe. Before that, Quakers had not had creeds, but we became a very creedal people, so that we were headed toward division. There were people who worked very, very hard to prevent division among friends. But there were other people who thought the time's come, if there's going to be peace, we're just going to have to separate and go our own way. Let the Orthodox be Orthodox and let the liberals be liberals. One of the leaders of the liberal wing was a man called Elias Hicks. He was a Long Island farmer, but he's also a spellbinding preacher. And he traveled among friends. He traveled to Philadelphia a great deal. He's probably one of the best known friends in America during his ministry. He lived from 1748 to 1830. And he had come to represent the point of view of the liberal friend. But the division among friends was not just a religious one. It was a social, it had social reasons and political reasons. The rural friends were not as well educated, not as well traveled, and so they came to resent the fact that the city friends had all the, most of the power within a society. There were Philadelphia friends who held the office of clerk of the yearly meeting for maybe 20 years. It was kept into a very tight group of people that knew what friends ought to believe and who was worthy of leadership. And so there came to be a lot of resentment as well as religious differences. And so in 1827, Philadelphia yearly meeting split with a great deal of discord, families divided, and it was an ugly thing. 1828, New York, Baltimore, Ohio, and Indiana yearly meetings split. In the East, there were about 50-50 splits. In some cases, New York yearly meetings a little more Hicksite than Orthodox. Indiana, not many of them were Hicksite friends. The story that a Quaker preacher told, it wrote in Quaker Life some years ago, about a woman minister, an Orthodox minister, was going on one of her trips, and a neighbor had agreed to take her on this visit, and in the course of the trip, he just happened to tell her that he had had to borrow a horse from a Hicksite friend. She said, "You mean this horse belongs to Hicksite?" And he said, "Yes." She said, "Well, let's go home." She wouldn't go on a visit drawn by a Hicksite's horse. And so we had some bitterness and ugliness that ill becomes friends. From my earlier reading, you found that I was a liberal in an Orthodox yearly meeting, because that were the only people around Dublin for me to associate with, was going to associate with friends. And when I became a friend then, it indicated that it didn't make a great deal of difference what my beliefs were. But then I found out, if you have different beliefs, you better keep your mouth shut about it. You better not tell people what your beliefs are, if you want to get along. I had not realized how unwelcome liberal opinions were among Orthodox friends. Since I'm not a preacher, I worked elsewhere to make a living, I spoke up. I'd followed the work of biblical scholarship. I knew what critical biblical study had done to fundamentalism. Though one time when the Faith and Life Conference was meeting in Indianapolis, Friends of the World Committee had sponsored a conference of Quakers. It was sort of an effort to get unity among Quakers. But actually it was started by the Orthodox branch, and it was a great deal of pressures on for us to be Orthodox, for to get our act together. So I wrote a paper that I just read a little bit of it. I wrote that another compelling reason for writing this letter is my strong conviction that we do not have a future over the long haul if we insist on ignoring what has been learned about the Bible and its message during the past 100 years of serious Bible study. An open-minded study of the massive amount of material available to us will surely convince us that we can, in honesty, have whole different views about biblical events and persons. I shall be eternally grateful to those who, during my time of disillusionment with dogmatic religion, helped me to believe that a man need not take leave of his mental faculties to be a Christian. At the time when I was sorely needed confirmation of my feelings about God, what God was like, my eyes fell on these words of Nels Ferre. Nels Ferre wrote a beautiful little book called The Sun and the Umbrella. As far as I know, he was never considered anything but an Orthodox Christian. He came here from Sweden as a young man. He taught at Andover Newton Seminary. He taught at Vanderbilt Seminary. Never considered anything but an Orthodox man. But then I read this of what he said. The God of love needs no placating.